Okay, anyway, thank you very much, everyone, for coming. And, of course, thank our host and hostess. Thank you very much for having me and for having all of us. I think this is our third Shir together, and it's a pleasure to be back here as well this Shabbos. This Parshas Noso, for many of us, stands out because it's the single longest Parsha in the Torah. If you're making lunch plans and trying to estimate when people are going to come home from shul, keep that in mind. It's the single longest parsha in the Torah. Although, the mark of a good gabbai is to realize that in advance and to pick chazanim, keeping that strategically in mind. But after you get through all the repetition of the lists and the names of the shvatim and the nesiim, so there are some important mitzvos or storylines or personalities, nazi or sota and the like, that are in the parsha. And one mitzvah in particular, which I think has a special place in our heart as Olim in Eretz Yisrael, is the mitzvah of Birkas Kohanim, of Duchening, or as it's known in its halachic terms, as we'll see, Nesias Kapayim, which refers to how the Kohanim put out their hands. And time permitting, I want to discuss one, and permitting, two things. One, which is the most dramatically impacting all of us, which is that when we came from America to here, all of a sudden we were confronted with a new reality. In America, they only dochen on Yontif. And in Eretz Yisrael, they dochen every day. So, of course, the question is obvious. You know, one of them seems to be the rule. We need to know, A, which one is that? And B, then, once we'll know that, we got to figure out what in the world is going on with the other one. Because we don't have any other example of something like this that's so dramatic. If you'll tell me somehow it's a mitzvah satzlius baritz, which it's not, but even if you'll do it, okay, so then you should never do it in America or in Chutz Laretz. But the idea of having a mitzvah which doesn't seem to have any connection to Eretz Yisrael per se, and yet there's a dramatic difference between Eretz Yisrael and all of Chutz Laretz, is very bizarre. If we have time permitting, even though I didn't really put it on the sheet, but I do have some notes just to share with you a little bit, which is Baruch HaZachinu, now that we are in Eretz Yisrael, so sometimes we take Tiulim, especially in the spring. Where's the most popular place to go in Israel? Up to the Galil, up to the north. So you may have had experiences, depending on where you were, whether it's in Tzfat, Tveria, Haifa area, which you go into a shul in a place or a yeshuv, etc., and you're in a minyan, and they don't dochen. They don't dochen. Not all, but in many places in the north, they do not dochen unless there is Musaf. If I'm not mistaken, most of those places that don't dochen, they will at least dochen on Shabbos. They don't wait till Yom Tov. They daven, they'll dochen whenever there's a Musaf. Right. But again, the question is, my high, what is going on? What is going on?
The Rambam doesn't mention any difference.
As we will see momentarily, for most of Jewish history, it seems to be. Now, I want to just give you one word of caveat. I hope this will be the only time, but you never know. Life that I'll have to say this, but basically the whole premise of the Shir, the purpose of the Shir is something I don't know anything about. But what you mean to say is that when we end, we may still be in the place you are right now, which is that we may still not understand why. But at least we're going to try. We're going to give it an A for effort, and I'm happy to take you a little bit, so to speak, on the journey with me. But this is one of those things where I have a feeling that I still know, after all the research that I did, I still know nothing about why this is. But let's just begin very briefly just with the sketch, starting really at the very beginning, which is our parsha. If you take a look on the top source on your page, we have the psukim in Perek Vav of Sefer Bamidbar, and also when Hashem tells Moshe to tell Aaron, to tell his children, all Kohanim in the future, Ko Sevarchu es Bnei Yisrael. That's the famous phrase, which seems to be B'loshon Tzivoy. It's a command that Aaron and his children, the Kohanim, are supposed to bless the Jewish people. And what should they say? Emor Lehem. The famous psukim, Yivrach Hashem v'yishmerecha, Ya'er Hashem panav elecha v'yichunecha, and finally, Yisa Hashem panav elecha, v'yaseim lecha shalom. And the Torah concludes this with, seems like almost an afterthought, v'samu eshmiya b'nei Yisrael, v'ani yivarchem, which kind of relates to something which maybe we could do next year, not so, I'm not going to discuss today, which is the whole interplay between the Kohanim and Bonar Shalom. And after all, who's really giving the bracha? So, you know, the Kohanim are saying the words, but as a result of that, Ani, Hashem lets you know, Avarchem. The bracha is really coming from Hashem. So what, well, if it's really coming from Hashem, so what role does the Kohanim play? So that's a shir in its own right. That's not tonight's shir, but that is, of course, an interesting question and a shir in its own right. So let's focus now on the issue at hand, which is when are we supposed to do this? There are a lot of whys and other things we could discuss, but as I say, that's not what I want to focus on. I want to discuss when do we do this? When is this mitzvah supposed to take place? So the Rambam, discussing this in the 14th chapter, Perek Yedalet of Hilchos Tefillah, just says very matter-of-factly, when do you do this? B'Shacharis, during Shacharis, and Musaf, Shabbos, and the like. If there's an Ne'ilah, which nowadays they only have once a year, but there was a time in history where on fast days they had an Ne'ilah. HaKohanim Nosin Kapehen. Now, at least in this presentation, the Rambam doesn't make any distinctions, as you correctly anticipated. So let me ask you, if the Rambam doesn't limit it in time, doesn't mention anything about when, what's the implication?
They
do it every day. The whole context of this is the Rambam's halachos of daily prayer. And the Rambam, if there's something only on Rosh Chodesh, only on this, only on that, the Rambam would tell us. The Rambam doesn't say it. So it's not explicit, but it's a pretty obvious inference. But we don't have to rely on inferences. It's explicit in the Sefer HaChinuch. And the Chinuch, by and large, usually follows the Rambam Shita, so it's not a surprise. But the Sefer HaChinuch says very clearly, number one, B'chol Yom. When do you do this mitzvah? Every single day. No exceptions. And then, since I already told you the preview of what the purpose of the shiur is, so your wheels in the head might be turning. Maybe it's every day, but maybe only in certain places. But the Chinuch is there for us as well, says the Chinuch on the second line, U'b'chol makom. And the Chinuch didn't live in Eretz Yisrael. We don't really know who wrote it, but he probably lived in Spain. B'chol makom. B'chol zman b'chol makom. So b'chol zman b'chol makom, so what happened to New York, what happened to London, what happened to Krakow?
There are some places in Krakow
And the Galil, that's right.
Like,
so what happened?
Like Barcelona, Spain.
So what happened? What happened?
Well,
good, so Baruch Hashem, it's a learned crowd, but let's take it one step at a time so we're all on the same page. The Gemara, the comments are all good, we're going to get to all of it. The Gemara in Sota on Daf Lamed Ches is where these topics are discussed. So just very briefly, a few of the points which will lead us to the meat of the issue. Rabbi Shimon ben Levi says you should know that this is a very important mitzvah. Minayin she'HaKadosh Baruch Hu mis'aveh Lebrakas Kohanim, right? It's a very suggestive and strong phrase. HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't just command these brachos, he is desirous of these brachos. Again, intriguing, it seems as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to bless us, but he needs the Kohanim, and therefore he's kind of egging the Kohanim on. Open, you know, I gave you the key, but you gotta open the door for me. And what's the basis of that? The pasuk we saw above, pasuk of Zion, v'samu shemi al bnei Yisrael, v'ani avarchem kohanim. If you'll do it, ani avarchem, I will bless them. Shmuel ben Levi says, but this is also responsibility, right? It's the same message we give our kids. Privileges comes with responsibilities and expectations. Kol kohen shemavarech misbarech, v'sheinu mevarech, ein misbarech. You should just know, kohanim, it's a great thing that you're doing, and if you'll do it, you will be blessed. But with that privilege comes tremendous responsibility. If you don't do it, then you will suffer the consequences as well. And that comes from a pasuk in Bereishis. And finally, the point that's most relevant for us, Yehoshua ben Levi says, where I have it underlined, called Kohen Shein Ola Leduchen, Kohen who has an opportunity to give the brachos and he doesn't, Over B'Shlosha Asei. Gemara says that he is violating three mitzvos and quotes all three psukim from the chapter we just read above, from our parsha this week, from Naso, Kosavarchu, Emor Lehem, Vesamu Eshmi. Now, just as an important aside, the Gemara probably does not mean that literally. It probably does not mean that there's three separate mitzvos. It's probably just a statement of exaggeration, but exaggeration to underlie and to underscore how important the mitzvah is. It's probably one mitzvah, but the fact that it's one mitzvah that's repeated three times, that's even more striking than if it was three different mitzvos. Why repeat the same mitzvah three times? Right? So sometimes, you know, my children will ask me, why are you repeating that three times? So the answer I usually give them is because you didn't listen the first time. But the unstated reason is because it's really important. If it wasn't important, then I might have let it go, but because it's important, I have to repeat it. So the Gemara says, Berkas Kohanim three times. Kosev Archeim, that's really the mitzvah, that's a tzivui. But the other two, right away, boom, boom, boom. Highlight it. But is every Gemara, every source that we see that highlights the importance, only makes our problem worse. It just begs the question, what is going on in Chutz Laretz? So you'll say, well, maybe, you know, that's just the Gemara. The Gemara is hypothetical sometimes. The Gemara could be academic, could be theoretical. How do I know that this is tachlis? How do I know this is anything real? So we are, whenever we want another real answer, we go to the Shulchan Aruch. You know, Jewish tradition and halacha has been distilled from centuries upon centuries into many of the conclusions of the Shulchan Aruch. What does Shulchan Aruch say? So in chapter 129, Kuf Chav Tes, says the Shulchan Aruch, Ein Nesias Kapayim Ela, not Eretz Yisrael, Ela, Shachris, Musaf, Ne'ila, who is the Shulchan Aruch paraphrasing? The Rambam. Excellent, the Rambam. Yeah, it's just basically paraphrasing the Rambam.
He's focusing on the fact that it's not in Mincha and Maariv.
Correct, which is also in the Rambam. I just didn't give you the whole Rambam. Okay? Why, by the way, it's just a striking point, by the way. Why is it not at Mincha? The same reason that we duchen on Shachris on Simchas Torah. Why do we duchen on Shachris on Simchas Torah? We're worried that the Kohanim could have a little too much to drink. So what's just striking is that that you think that's only one day a year fear.
Wait, what happened?
The fear, very simple. It's a long day. It's a long day. No, it's a long day. It's a long day. By the time people have gone through the whole day, you know, either it's the accumulation of a little drink here, a little drink there, or, you know, you can have a rough afternoon.
Very
mikubal to have wine. Yeah, in certain countries, Adi Yom HaZed, that could be the lunch drink, and, you know, maybe the after lunch drink, and the... Right? But again, what's striking is this is a daily concern. This affects the halacha daily. I don't think this is all the sources. I'm just noticing all that.
Just
now. Oh, okay, yeah. Oh, here. Pass that down to Michael. Yeah. Okay. So, the bottom line is, what do we see again from the Shulchan Aruch? The same thing from the Rambam. Now, what did we say from the Rambam? The fact that the Rambam never says any limiting principle, only here, only there, implies that when is Birkas Kohanim? Every day. Now, we, as clever as we are, we were medayik that in the Rambam. But we don't have to be so clever when it came to the Shulchan Aruch, because the Mishnah Berurah did the work for us. There's the Mishnah Berurah, just a simple Ha'ara. When the Shulchan Aruch says you have to duchen at Shachris, what did the Shulchan Aruch mean? Hainu, b'chol yom. Every day. So, again, the issue is more difficult. What is going on? Now, in terms of when is the earliest, anyone know when the earliest record is of not doing Birkas Kohanim in Chutz La'aretz? Anyone have any idea? Actually, I think in Shabbatai Tzvi they tried to renew it, because it was so predates Shabbatai Tzvi, if I'm not mistaken. I believe the answer is about 700 years ago. Take a look. One of my indications for that number is the Beis Ephraim. We're going to skip the Shulchan Aruch. We'll get back to it in a moment. The Shut Beit Ephraim. The Shut Beit Ephraim is written by one of the great, great Gedolim of all time, of the last early 19th century, I believe, Rabbi Ephraim Zalman Margolios. Anyone know the name? You may be familiar, some of you, with one of his Sfarim, which is perhaps the most famous, which is the Mate Ephraim, which is like a classic work of halacha on Chodesh Tishrei. So you have all of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot, and the Mate Ephraim. That's ubiquitous during that time of year. We hear about the Mate Ephraim. So he was one of the great, great Gedolim. I don't know his entire biography, if I'm not mistaken. In the early part of his life, as he was amassing this enormous bekius, and he was actually a businessman and quite successful. So later in life, he became the Rav of Brody. If I'm not mistaken, I don't even know if he took a salary, or if he did, it was very minimal, because by then he was already independently wealthy. But I think he was in the money. I think he was one of the Jews who got into the money business, and he Torah v'gedula b'makom echad. You know, when I was younger, they used to tell him, you know, that's a big nisayon, you know, to be Sirach. And I used to daven for the nisayon. Hashem, I could do it. Give me the Torah and the gedula. So anyway, we still have to daven. So Rav Zalman Margolios is not the only one. There are other gedolim in history who've had that rare combination. He was one of them. So he, in the time that he lived, you know, he was like an older contemporary of the Chassam Sofer, for example. The way the Chassam Sofer talks about him is like from Moshe Rabbeinu to Ephraim Zalman Margolios. I mean, he was really a giant, not only in his time, but for all time. So in his day, people were agitating to reinstitute Birkas Kohanim in Europe. And he was very against it. He wrote a very long, I only gave you a very small sample, it's probably the single largest, most comprehensive treatment of the topic in all of the Achronish literature. And in the beginning, as he's writing to this young whippersnapper who dares try to change what was then the practice, he says, I just want to let you know, before I tell you all the substantive reasons why you're wrong, let me first tell you why it's even a chutzpah for you to raise the issue. And he just points out a historical fact. He says, this is a minhag kadum, yoter min chamesha meos shana. So he's writing over 200 years ago, and at the time, he says it's over 500 years before his day. If I'm not mistaken, in terms of our literature, I believe the earliest reference we have is in the Maharami Rutenberg, and then in his Talmidim. So,
it's funny, because that would shake me, that 500 years ago, they used the Dochen and they stopped Dochen. It's one thing when you take on a minhag to do something and say, oh, you don't want to give that up. But here, they gave up Birchat Kohanim, and they wanted
fair
to
point.
Do
it. So I'll explain. Like, the answer, which I think clearly he believes is religiously significant, but it starts with something psychological, which is, if we would all of a sudden overturn it, so what are we saying about the 700 years, or in his case, the 500 years of Rabbanim who didn't do it? Not only were the Rabbanim who didn't do it, many of the greatest Gedolim we had were Kohanim. He writes that out. The Shach of Shabtai HaKohen Rappaport, that's the most Meyuchas family name that we have of Kohanim. Right? Who's his great-great-grandson? Shabtai HaKohen Rappaport, who's alive and well today, living in Yerushalayim. Rabbi married to Moshe Feinstein's oldest granddaughter, Moshe Tendler's oldest daughter. Right? My kids go to her school, Rappaport. That comes not from a philanthropist who gave the money. That comes from the Rappaports. Right? Now, my kids aren't Kohanim, but they let them into the school anyway. So, the Shach didn't try to start Berkas Kohanim. So, that's where he's coming from. He's coming from, you should just know, who do you think? This is, now, that doesn't answer the question, why not? But that's kind of like, again, and I agree, not everyone's going to take it as seriously as him, and you're going to be a very good company in a second. But at least he, as a major guttle, he is bothered by that. And again, I just think it's significant that he points it out. He quotes some of the earlier Rishonim. Just two quotes, I won't even read them inside for you, but he quotes the Tashbetz, and then on the bottom line, the Kolbo. So again, these are later Rishonim, not 1,000 years ago, but 700 or so, give or take. 700 or so years ago is a long, long time ago. So this has been going on for a long time with lots of great Jews. So again, this is not a resolution or explanation, but it's still sketching and deepening the issue. Now, on the one hand, that clearly seems to have been the minhag. Like, for example, if you look above, what is the Shulchan? What we already saw is Shulchan Aruch, who said you should do it every day. But if you look one source above in the Ramah, where I have it underlined, Nahagu, so you see what happened. It became the minhag not to do it. You see? So what does the Ramah say, writing a little bit later, in Krakow, in Poland? Nagu b'chol medinos elu. Right? Not just in Krakow, not just in my backyard, and perhaps he means not even just in Poland, in Lithuania, and in Russia, and all of Ashkenaz, says the Ramah. Ein nosin kapeim ela b'yomtiv. Now he's going to give a reason. We're going to get back to that reason in a few minutes. But we clearly see the lines in the sand. We see many makaros with Chumash and the Gemara and the Rambam and the Chinuch and the Shulchan Aruch. You should duchen every day. No discussion of time or place. Doesn't matter Israel, not Israel, and doesn't matter what day of the week. And yet, somehow, like a rabbit coming out of the hat, we have no idea where it came from. We sort of know when, but we don't know why. All of a sudden, there developed this minhag that people weren't doing it. And yet, is that a good minhag or not? Says the Magen Avram, the following source, minhag garuahu. Not all minhagim are created equal. As an aside, I'll just, as a recovering pulpit rabbi, I could tell you that it's always a very tricky thing when a rabbi comes into a new shul. I'll weigh my words carefully because this is being taped. But try never say anything in front of a room of audience, which you wouldn't want the whole world to know anyway. But in any shul, in any rabbi, when a new rabbi comes in, he's presented with all sorts of reality which predates him. And of course, anything that anyone likes in the shul is enshrined in the word, the minhag. So, but every rabbi inevitably will have some things that he's really happy about and other things which he's not as happy about. And every rabbi has to make a decision. I'm not even discussing strategically how to do it and getting board support and all the politics of it. I'm talking strictly in principle. Which things does a rabbi say, you know what, maybe it's not how I would have done it, but this is the minhag of the shul and this is what we do here. And when are you willing to go to the mat and say, I know you've been doing it this way, but really it's something you should change? I think most good substantive rabbis probably do yes and yes. Any rabbi who comes in and changes everything will probably not be long for the job. But unless the person is like the rabbi of the Beis HaMikdash or something, there are probably things that a shul's been doing that may not be so great, and maybe a rabbi should change. And without boring you with any of the specifics or the details, but that's exactly what happened when I went to Baltimore. There were certain things which I didn't love, but people would ask me, I would say, well, that's what my predecessor, you know, that's what the rabbi before me did, that's what you've all been done. I hid behind that, even though I didn't really love it. And there were other things, sometimes, you know, even a little bit controversial, which I changed. Now, if you ask me, why did you pick that one and not that one, that's not always an easy question to answer, and doesn't mean I would share the answer with you anyway. But it's honestly not an easy answer. Sometimes it's the instinct of the rabbi. Sometimes not every issue is the same. Not every minhag is the same. And that's what you see from this Magen Avraham. The Magen Avraham isn't denying that in his day already you have a 500-year-plus minhag. But the Magen Avraham is saying, so what? That doesn't give it legitimacy. It's wrong. It's a minhag garua. So take a look at the bottom of the page.
Second, the Mishnah Berurah doesn't make a comment on this.
He makes a not the significant. The only thing the Mishnah Berurah really tells us, actually, I could have put it on the sheet. He says you should just know that this has nothing to do with Eretz Yisrael. He says this is not a mitzvah hatzuliyah ba'aretz. Apparently, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, this is a striking thing. Rabbi Yaakov Emden believed that it was only a mitzvah from the Torah to do the Birkas Kohanim every day in the Beis HaMikdash. And the Mishnah Berurah quotes this and says it's a mistake, though. He says the mitzvah, he quotes a medrash. It really seems to be against. There's a medrash, a sifra, that says no, b'chol makom v'chol zman, basically, which is what the Sefer HaChinuch had already said. So, but doesn't really, Mishnah Berurah, again, in Radin, they didn't duchen. And it was just ho hum already. You know, at that point, it's already ho hum. This is what we do in Chutz Loretz. So, attention is first paid to this in the Beis Yosef. Well, actually, I take it back. Let's, before we get to try to some explanations, so what we've already been talking about and hinting at, but we haven't seen any sources discussed yet, explicitly is the fact that despite this new minhag, garua, not garua, that came about of doing the duchening every day, nevertheless, it seems to be limited to a certain place, and that is not Israel. How do we know that in Israel they're duchening every day? We haven't seen that yet. We've seen poskim say you should duchen every day, and then we've seen other poskim say, but our minhag is not to do it. Where do we see that it's a minhag that in Eretz Yisrael they did do it every day? So here the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef, of course, is written by Rav Yosef Karo, the Machaber, same author of the Shulchan Aruch. So in the Shulchan Aruch, he just tells you what he thinks is the right thing to do, and he doesn't limit it to time or place. But in the Beis Yosef, which is his longer comments, he first notes that in Ashkenaz they don't do it, in Chutz Laaretz they don't do it, and he doesn't like it. He doesn't like it. But then look at the last two lines of the Beis Yosef. The last two lines, he says, Yasher Koyach. Well, maybe he wouldn't pronounce it that way. But Yashar Kocham, he says, Shel Bnei Eretz Yisrael V'chol Malchus Mitzrayim. An interesting footnote. I don't know if it means just Mitzrayim, or perhaps it was an Egyptian empire that went beyond the borders of Egypt. Lands that were influenced by Sfarad and Mitzrayim, even the Chutz Laaretz, Shenosim Kapeim B'chol Yom. They do it every day. And he gives them a big, hearty Yasher Koyach. A second and very important historical source that we have for this is the Pa'as HaShulchan. Pa'as HaShulchan was written by Yisrael of Shklov, who was everyone. He's very famous as the Talmud, as the student of. Who's he the student of? Anyone know? The Pa'as HaShulchan? One of the premier students of the Vilna Gaon. So the Yishuv, which we have all joined in Eretz Yisrael, so who was one of the main contributors that built up the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael? We know. Talmidei HaGra, the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. Well, of the Talmidim of the Gra, who made Aliyah, the most famous is Rabbi Yisrael of Shklov. He made Aliyah, he left the Vilna Gaon, he left Europe, and he moved to Eretz Yisrael, and it was a lot less built up than it is now. And he wrote a sefer called the Pa'as HaShulchan, which is the laws of Hilchos Eretz Yisrael. You can imagine, when you're running away from Minsk to Pinsk, and all the places the Jews were going to in Europe, so that just to keep their heads wits about them, and to write about regular halachos, preoccupied their time. It wouldn't be, it's not surprising that when you look and find whether it's a Galician or a Polish or a Russian Greg Gödel in 18th century, 19th century, they didn't weren't preoccupied with like Shemitah. Right? Because they had their own things to worry about. But this became halacha l'maisa for him, because he made Aliyah.
Is that one of the reasons that the minhagim of the Gra?
Yes, absolutely, because when they came, it was not fertile ground. Or I should say, it was fertile ground for someone to influence. Meaning there was nothing pre-existing. What I told you about when rabbis come and they have to deal with minhagim, when they got there, it was the Wild West. So that's exactly the case, 100%. You had I think, a slightly earlier aliyah of the Talmidim of the Besht. He had some early Hasidic, second generation Hasidim who came, second or third generation, early Hasidim. And then shortly afterwards, you also had Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. And of course, before any of them, you had Sephardi Jews. I don't know if there was any natives, because we, of course, had been dispersed, but there was already a Sephardi population, and then you had these two Ashkenazic populations, Hasidic and Misnagdish, that joined. If you take a look at the Pat HaShulchan, he gives a historical reference. Again, it's important just for the history. He says, Minog Yofe, B'chol Eretz Yisrael, Shakohanim Nosim Kapehem, B'chol Yemos HaChol. Again, he confirms. And again, you see, it's almost like he sings with childlike eyes. It's a new reality. His whole life, he's a big gadol, Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. There's no duchening. Shows up in Eretz Yisrael, and wow! First day goes to shul, and the Kohanim are duchening. Amazing. And then he adds, it happened in Sfarad as well. And he adds in his own little ha'oros, and he footnotes his own work, footnote 23, Chav Gimel, he points out that the influence really goes back to the Rambam influenced the Sfaradim came to Eretz Yisrael. And as a result, he puts it, they duchen every day, Shabbos Nyantav, Kados, meaning correctly, appropriately. You know, he's not diplomatic doublespeak and, you know, politically correct. There's right and there's wrong. I came from Chutzlords, they were doing it wrong. Now we come to Eretz Yisrael, and they're doing it Kados. They're doing
it correctly. Is it a Minhag or a
I'm struggling with the jump that we have from very clear language in the Chumash.
Yes.
Sibui, and then
good.
All the rabbinic literature seems to turn into Minhag.
Yes.
You know, Minhag Tov, Minhag Geruah.
No, we're not saying that Birkas Kohanim is a Minhag. It is a mitzvah. The question is, what is the practice? Should we do this mitzvah then? Should we do this mitzvah now? That's it. But you're right, it's still difficult. Again, I'm not sure if you were here when I said this, but when I started the shiur, one of the first things I said was, I hope this doesn't happen too often in my career, but this is I'm giving a shiur about a topic I know nothing about. Because even after all my research, I still don't know the answer. Now, I'm going to give you a few of the answers, but I hope to show you that they're not so persuasive. But one last thing, before I try to defend your Elder Babas and Zedas and maybe your other loved ones who are still Nebuch held hostage in Chutz Laaretz, that's for the tape. I had to let one thing in. I'm in a yeshuv, you know, Chashmonaim, Greenline, everything. Okay, 67. So, two other points of history. Again, I think if you saw the title of the shiur, I think I called it Halacha, History, and Geography. So we've seen a little bit of all of it already, but let me give you one more historical footnote, which is like amazing and spooky. If you take a look at the next source, it is the responsa of the great Netziv, the Netziv of Volozhin, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin. He's a prolific, prolific author, and his Tshuva Sefer was called the Meshiv Davar. So he writes the following, that he heard from his Mechutin, Rav Itzala of Volozhin. Who's Rav Itzala of Volozhin? Rav Chaim's son, the famed Rav Chaim's son, who was the successor, and before him, the Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin. Shepam Echad, this is, you gotta, it's good that we're all sitting, because this is the kind of thing you have to sit for. Pam Echad, Hiskim Rabbeinu Hagro, Lahanhi Gamkin B'chol Yom B'Beis Midrasho. Apparently, the Vilna Gaon, either on his own volition, and or persuaded by interested Talmidim, the Gro reached a decision in Vilna, that basically, it's all wrong. Who needs terutzim? Let's just do the right thing. And he reached a decision. He said, tomorrow everyone come to shul. We're going to do Birkas Kohanim. And what happened that day? It didn't go well. Why not? Listen to the words of the Netziv. The Netziv is not a Hasidic Rebbe, with all the respect to Rebbes. He's not a Kabbalist, with all the respect to Kabbalists. He's a prime example of a Halachist. Says the Netziv, V'ikvuhu min hashamayim. God got in the way. Hashem didn't let it happen. I'm not enough historian to know exactly the history of this, but we know there are all sorts of interesting battles, usually between Jews and other Jews. Maybe sometimes it was anti-Semites, you know, jumped in for the fun too, because why not? But obviously it wasn't, the Vilna Gaon spent his life in jail. I don't know the whole story. Obviously he got out shortly afterwards. But there was some machlokes, there was some scandal, and sure enough, instead of going into shul to lead Birkas Kohanim, the Vilna Gaon is hauled off to jail. Like, okay, you know, a week or 2 weeks later, you could do the Birkas Kohanim also. The Vilna Gaon apparently took it as a simon. He took it as a sign that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want him to do this, and he never tried again. But what happens? Good ideas resurface. So the next generation, Reb Chaim Volozhiner, Gadol Hador, the founder of the whole modern yeshiva world, first yeshiva, or Volozhin, he came up with the idea, he said, I'm going to do it also. He says, tomorrow we're going to do it. And sure enough, what happened that night? Nisrav chatz ya'ir ubeis hakneses shebe'ir. There was a huge fire in Volozhin. Half the city burned down, including the shul. Uru'u v'hisboninu shiesh v'ze'ez davar sod besitrei hashbar habracha hayoed alidei beit hakneset b'chol. Chaim Volozhiner took it as a sign once again from heaven. This is not meant to be. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us doing it. I will add, I didn't put it on the sheet, but some of you may be familiar with, there's a modern day sefer called Piskei Tshuvos. It's the son of the Biala Rebbe. It's a Hasidic Shaposo who put out the book, but it's a collection of halachic works. But because he's a Hasid, so he has a lot of Hasidic Makoros in there. So he points out in a footnote that in the Lubavitcher tradition, in the Likutei Sichos, they point out that the Baal HaTanya, the first and founding Chabad Rebbe, also had a similar story. So whatever was different between the Vilna Gaon, the arch enemy of Hasidus, and the Baal HaTanya, was from that early generation of Rebbes who was a big, you know, lochem. One thing they both had in common, they both wanted to do Birkas Kohanim, and one thing they had in common, Hashem said no. So say, oh, okay, this is like really weird and spooky, but it's like a long way away, and the Vilna Gaon, anyway, he was a Kabbalist. Take a look at the next source, the Aruch HaShulchan. Aruch HaShulchan, right? Early 20th century, classic, pure halacha sefer, Aruch HaShulchan. What does he say? First of all, again, like what you wanted. Hine vaday ein shum tam. Like Josh, like you said, ein shum tam nachun haminageinu. Says the Aruch HaShulchan, right? Writing from the Vardak, Posek. This is before there was Musar in the Vardak. He was just a Posek in the Vardak. He says, no beating around the bush. It's wrong. Ein tam nachun haminageinu. Why aren't we doing this in Chutz Laretz? Nevertheless, he says, you should just know. Mana ases, second line. Amazing. Uki'ilu bas kol yotze shlo lahaniach lano lisa kapayim. Says Aruch HaShulchan, what can I do? I can fight against other Rabbanim, maybe. I can fight against the Baal HaBatim. I can fight against the Tsar, whoever. I can't fight against heaven. It's as if a bas kol, he's not claiming to have heard a bas kol, but he says it's so obvious that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not want us to do it. It's as if a bas kol came out. Sure enough, he doesn't name names. So what does he say in the continuation? Umekublani. There's an oral tradition in Litta, among Ashkenazim and Chosrars, there's an oral tradition handed down from generation to generation that what? Sheshnei gedolei hador b'dorei shelefanenu kol echa bimkomo rotza lahanig nisiyas kapayim b'chol yom. Two other gedolim tried this, and when the day came, the balbel ha'inyan v'lo olalahem, something out of the ordinary occurred to prevent them from doing it, v'amru, and they each reached the same conclusion. Shroim ki min hashamayim nigzerakein. Obviously, the Rabbanu Shalom doesn't want us. But again, I say I don't know anything I'm talking about. Because if you ask me to know, why does HaKadosh Baruch Hu not want? I don't know. Aruch HaShulchan didn't know. The Nesiv didn't know. How am I supposed to know? But yet, we have this phenomenon. So I want to spend, again, I don't know that we're going to end up having time to get into the Galil. It's, you know, part of the marketing. I have to leave you wanting more. I wanted to discuss, if we're going to hold firm to our 9 o'clock ending, so I don't know if we'll have a chance to get to the Galil. But let me, I'll give you one minute.
On.
Yeah, of course.
Historically, though, is it established that not just Eretz Yisrael and Mitzrayim, but Kilot or Edot Mizrach?
Yes. Yes, if you turn back, let's turn.
Edot Mizrach worldwide, not just Eretz Yisrael.
I don't know if every community worldwide, but throughout the world, there are Sephardi kilos to do it. For example, if you go to Brooklyn, I don't know about all, but many of the Syrian shuls, they dochen. For example. And in other places, yes, that's correct. If you take a look, you saw, like, in the Beis Yosef, he quotes Malchus Mitzrayim, the Pasa Shulchan also talked about this as well. What are you referring to?
Asia's in Asia.
Where were you pointing?
The end of the last line in the Aruch HaShulchan.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't read that. But exactly.
Milo was just in like Malaysia, and he said the shul, wherever, I don't know what city, what's the city in Malaysia.
Kuala Lumpur? Is that Kuala Lumpur?
Something like that.
Impressive. Jakarta. That's Indonesia, isn't it?
Then they don't.
Okay. So what are their possible reasons? So I'll give you a kitzer of the lineup of reasons that have been suggested. Again, I can't say this is completely unique, but this is pretty unique, pretty rare in halachic history, to have something in which the makoros are so overwhelming in one direction, and yet you have such a well-respected, long-standing minhag in the exact opposite direction. It's not like, well, you know, the Belzers do it this way, but the Bubbafers do it this way, or, you know, Flatbush for Zamora Park. I mean, this is like a wall called Ashkenaz.
Talis for Bar Mitzvah Boy in Ashkenaz.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Okay, that's true. Right, that's a fair point. That's a fair point, right. But I don't know if there were any fires. And I don't know, and more seriously, for whatever reason, I don't know of any example that's parallel to the Vilna Gaon, their kind of a Lajner, trying, you know, like, to reinstitute it or something. Here you have this real tension.
Right, there were no fires because nobody tried to put it on.
Yeah, okay. Anyone's talus ever caught on fire? Okay. Anyway, so what are some of the reasons that are suggested to try to defend this seemingly inexplicable reality? Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you take a look at the Beis Yosef, he quotes from the Maharil, probably one of, if not the earliest suggestion, but earliest does not make it credible necessarily. In the Beit Yosef, he says right in the beginning from the Maharil, I'll just paraphrase it, he says basically it all comes from the fact that traditionally the Kohanim used to go to mikveh before the Duchening. Right? Duchening is very kadosh, so go to mikveh to have extra special purity before the Duchening, and then what happened? You know what a European winter is like? And let's be honest, you should remember, the mikveh there was not tiled and, you know, heated with a filter, and it was basically the local river or sea. It was freezing. And therefore, to do this every day became too difficult. The problem with this is obvious, and the Beis Yosef himself says, I mean, that's a nice reason, the Maharil. The Maharil is one of the most biggest influences on all of Ashkenazic minhag. But nevertheless, says the Beis Yosef, I mean, it's hard to justify. There's no makor anywhere that says you have to go to the mikveh. So that's a nice thing. You want to be a mikveh yid? Great. But you don't get to do that because you can't do that. Therefore, you're not going to do a mitzvah d'oraisa. I mean, the halakhic calculus is completely messed up.
There is something about the avodah of a kohen. The avodah of a kohen in the mikdash was always, they would always go to the, they'd have to do tefillah before they did it.
Okay, but this is not in the mikdash. This is everywhere, and there's nothing. There's no halacha. You can look at Shulchan Aruch, look at the Gemara. There's nothing that says that you have to go to the mikvah. So it's a nice thing, but you know, because you can't do that, to throw out the baby with the bathwater, or the variation thereof, would seem to be very, very peculiar. But that's the first reason that's suggested. The most famous reason that's suggested is by the Ramah himself. If you go up, back to the middle of the page, the Ramah himself says the following. It's an important, especially with our diverse audience, it's an important context. The context is that the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah argue whether a single Kohen can duchen. Shulchan Aruch says, yeah, why not? I'm not talking about now the issue of under or over bar mitzvah. 15, 18, 19, I mean, by then he might be married already, but... A single boy. So the Ramah says, Yesh Omrim, single men should not. Why? Quoting the very famous Gemara, because Hashari below Isha, Shari below Simcha. Man cannot be happy, it's not Shalem, if he's not married. So that's obviously true, of course. No happiness if you don't have a good spouse. But so what? Where did that, what does that do with anything? So this is not made up by the Ramah. It comes from earlier sources. The Maharam Mirudberg and his Talmud, the Mordechai. You know, they're both casualties in the early Crusades. Rudenberg is kidnapped, spends the rest of his life and dies in jail. And his Talmud, the Mordechai, is killed and dies al Kiddush Hashem. The third one of that triumvirate, the Rosh, he's the only one, he escapes to Sfarad. But the other two had tragic endings. So the Maharam and the Mordechai have this idea that you shouldn't do it if you're single because maybe you're not going to be happy, and who cares? So it's interesting. We have delicious food here as well. So he says, what's the proof from the parsha that talks about when Yitzchak says to Esau, Yitzchak, he says, bring me the food and then I'll give you the bracha. So the way the Maharam understands it is, what's the way to a man's heart? had a good meal, he'd be besimcha, he could give Esav a bracha. So you see from that that if you want to give a good bracha, b'lev shalem, hafi ba'ahava, you have to have a good mood, you have to be besimcha. And from that, which is still a big chiddush, still a very big chiddush, this guy will chiddush al chiddush. So even if you want to see a single guy, maybe yes, maybe no, says the Rama, b'zman hazeh, every day in chutz laretz, we're not happy. Why are we not happy? So he says, because we're very worried about parnasa.
Well, in Eretz Yisrael, we're not worried about parnasa.
We don't need it here. We can live on we can live on kedusha.
We
exactly. It's in life. There's a direct correlation in life between happiness and expectations. Once you give up having any money in Israel, then you're fine. So
the source is not the Gemara on Shabbos that says.
I don't think he quoted it. It's a good point, but I don't know if he. Maybe I missed it.
Alicia.
I don't think he quoted it. No, I don't think so. I might have missed it, but I don't think so. I don't think so. So the Rama says you're going to be not so happy. We're worried about Parnassa and different things. Question is, what about Yom Tov? I'm not going to work. And Shabbos, I don't go to work. So it's a little bit weak, but that's.
Yeah, there's an inherent simcha on Yom Tov.
Why not Shabbos?
Own it. You don't have simcha.
Okay, interesting. That's the Rama's suggestion. We're running out of time. I just want to tell you a few more, and then we can hopefully come close to the 9 o'clock starting time. Do we even have a minute? So maybe I don't have to start at 9. Okay, I don't know what the standards are here. Okay.
We dive in with 8.
With a minion? With 8? So just to give you a few of the other reasons, then we will stop minion or otherwise. The Beis Ephraim himself, Ephraim Zahar Margolius, on the second to last source, he says something which is part of a larger controversial discussion. He says, nowadays we don't really know who is a Kohen and who isn't. We work with the assumption that if your father and your father's father and your father's father's father told you you're a Kohen, you're a Kohen. But you're a Kohen that's called Kohane Chazaka. It's a presumption. But to be a Meyuchas, virtually short of the Rappaport family, we don't have that anymore. We don't have that anymore. So other posts can discuss this with regard to things like Pidyon HaBen and the like. But as far as I know, the first person who ever discussed this about Berkas Kohanim is the Beis Ephraim. So he says, "No, so how does the Kohen even know he's a Kohen?" So you'll say, "Well, okay, so what?" Because there's a halacha, which is that a Zar, a non-Kohen, is not allowed to give the bracha. This is the underlying controversy for those who have the minhag, as my family does, of benching your children every Shabbos. And that's why, for example, there's a tradition that the Vilna Gaon, when he would bench his children or anyone else, he only used one hand. The Torah Tamima says because the Isser is to do it like a Kohen with two hands. There are other people who give other reasons. Come on, we're not really trying to be Kohanim, we're not usurping the Kahuna, we're just giving our kids a bracha, it's a nice pasuk. There are other explanations, but there are some poskim who are very worried about this minhag of benching your kids, and therefore have the practice of not using, let's say, one hand and the like. So similarly, says the Beis Ephraim, if you're not a Kohen, who gave you a right to go up there, plus you're going to say Hashem's name, who gave you a right to do that? So what does that help for Shabbos? I mean, what does that help for Yom Tov? We're not sure who's a Kohen, so why do we duchen on Yom Tov? So he basically says, listen, we got to have some vestige of kahuna. He basically is trying to balance it. Again, with all due respect, the question probably still better than the answer. But that's his attempt. And I just want to conclude so that those who want to leave can leave. And until I'm kicked out, I'm happy to stay and answer questions, but I don't want to hold people longer than 9 o'clock. The last reason I'll just mention here very briefly on the sheet is the Chasam Sofer. Chasam Sofer points out that all of this goes back ultimately to the Kohanim and the Beis HaMikdash, and like all tefillah that's connected to the Beis HaMikdash, Berkas Kohanim is a form of avodah, of service. Why is it uniquely Kohanim? It's like service like the Beis HaMikdash. So you have to have the right kavanas. After all, if you have the wrong kavana when you're bringing a karbon in the Beis HaMikdash, that's called pigul. It's totally disqualified. So during the week, again, people are preoccupied with parnasa. He doesn't say it has to do with being happy or not, but he says if you don't have the right kavana, then you're not going to. And even on Shabbos, apparently, you know, it is, especially in the winter, we barely get it. You know, Shabbos, we can still remember the last meeting and the argument we had in the office, you know, 10 hours before. Yom Tov already, somehow psychologically, especially in Chutz Laretz for the 2 days, somehow we feel more separated, more liberated. Again, a little bit of a kvetch, but that's the Chasam Sofer's suggestion. I'll mention to you just one last thing. For any Hungarians here? Okay, don't admit it, fine. I'm Polish and proud, just for the record, if you're keeping score at home. So, Rabbi Yailish, the Satmar Rebbe. So he has a very famous essay called Ma'amar Lashon HaKodesh. Probably say Kodesh. So he has a whole essay all about how Ivris, is not Lashon HaKodesh. Fe, pu, tzion.
Yiddish is.
Of course. No, in all seriousness. He says, well, listen, we all know half the words are recent and modern and made up. So he says the whole modern Hebrew is not Lashon HaKodesh. He has an essay called Ma'amar Lashon HaKodesh. For the record, if in case you're interested in the topic, that's where he discusses the whole issue of women's education. You know that in Satmar Beis Yaakov's, they don't even do Rashi on the Torah. So the Agudah is a bunch of hypocrites. So how can you tell them they can't learn Gemara's Torah Shabbat Pesach? How do you learn Rashi? So the purists are the Satmars. They don't even do it. So all that is in the same essay called Ma'amar Lashon HaKodesh. So there he says, you know why we can't do Birkas Kohanim? Because the Gemara in Sota says that Birkas Kohanim is one of the few things that has to be done in Lashon HaKodesh. You cannot do it in Laz. Davening, if you don't know Hebrew, you could say it in English. All sorts of things you can say in English, or Laz, French, Spanish. There are a few things, including Duchening and Birkas Kohanim, have to be Lashon HaKodesh. Says the Satmar Rebbe, we don't know exactly how to pronounce the words, which is rich, coming from Hungarian. They pronounce it differently than everybody. But again, so you said the Galician or Polish, you know, pronounces it this way, the Polish this way, the Litvak this way, the Yekka another way. What's the right way? The Svardi another way. We don't know how to pronounce it. And he seems to assume that there's one right way and every other way is not Hebrew. Which is an interesting discussion. So that's his suggestion. Be that as it may, I end where I started, which is that there is a mystery out there. I'm looking and looking for a really compelling explanation. I gave you four or five of them. I'm not sure that any of them are compelling to me. And the really only one solution was to move to Eretz Yisrael. Yishkoch to all of us. Okay, good Shabbos. Thank you for coming.